Hi, everyone. It is Hyalai time. Hey, did you know that Hyalai is Basque for Merry Festival?
No, I did not know that. But you know, I am a little jealous because you actually got to watch Hyalai live and in person in its heyday.
Hyalai in Newport, Greyhounds at the racetrack in Raynham, Harness Racing in Foxborough, and the Nags at Suffolk Downs.
I bet it was a scene.
Hey, back in those days, you still got decked out to go out and gamble, and there's cocktails, cologne, cigarettes, and all that stuff ruled the day.
You were just a kid.
And I loved getting all dolled up, spritzed in fragrance, and when no one was looking, I'd have a little sip of whatever was at hand.
At least you weren't smoking.
Not in front of anyone, but by 9, I was liberating cigarettes from my uncles and smoking with Crazy Kim behind the gym.
Please, you were still doing that into your 40s and hanging out the window.
But I wasn't stealing cigarettes from my uncles by then.
No, you were always sneaking out for a smoke.
I'll confess that I still miss smoking, but I also miss going to the Fronton to watch Hyalai. And since that's the topic of the day, let's jump right in.
Okay, not so fast, Smokey. You promised to answer David's question.
Sorry, I almost forgot. David wanted to know about Georgie Pappas, I think?
Yes, specifically why he was killed.
So the supposed reason behind the hit on Pappas was that he had ripped off a couple of Winter Hill associates in a drug deal that was backed by Whitey, Stevie, and Raymond by extension.
Well, that makes sense. I still wonder who the guys were that he burnt, though.
Likewise, and I racked my brain trying to recall conversations I was eavesdropping on back then, but I came up empty.
Well, maybe one of our listeners might know.
Well, if anybody has any theories or knows anything, please share it with us.
Okay, so before we jump in, can you explain briefly why Hyalai was so prone to corruption?
Why did you say briefly?
Well, he could at least try.
Okay. I'm not sure I can give the exact why, but I can give some examples or some background. So Florida was and is the primary home of Hyalai in the States. Currently, it is only played in Florida. It's no secret that wherever there was an opportunity to place a bet, there was an opportunity for organized crime to flourish. In 1924, the first Fronton in Florida was opened. In 75, it moved from the Hialeah racetrack to a spot not far from the airport where it still remains to this day. At the time when they moved into their new digs, it was the biggest venue, holding up to 15,500 at any given time. There were multiple locations in Florida, followed by Connecticut, Rhode Island, and a short-lived appearance in Vegas.
Well, Kurt Kerkorian certainly did take a bath, and Hyalai didn't even survive 2 years in Vegas.
Let's get into the gambling aspect of Hyalai. Although it is a team sport, betting doesn't behave like a normal ball game. There aren't point spreads, but rather bets are placed like they are in a dog or horse race in a pari mutuel way. It was years until I figured out what my uncles were talking about when they'd ask what the mutch was. They were talking about the street lottery number, but I had no idea that it was slang for pari mutuel. Anyhow, you are betting on a single round of play, but rather matches with 8 teams cycling through until the end of the match, and then they are ranked win, place, show, and fourth. If you bet 4, it's a superfecta, 3 a trifecta, 2 a quinella. You can box your bet so that you'll still win, even if the teams don't rank in the exact order that you place the bet.
Are you sure you're not a degenerate gambler?
I'm positive, but I can't say that for the company I've kept over the years.
Well, no comment there.
Okay, back to the matter at hand. That betting system made it perfect for a little mob magic. The gaming commissions in Florida and Connecticut tried to stay on top of Hyalai, but they just couldn't keep up. By 1976, the Connecticut Gaming Commission demanded the head of World Hyalai resign. At that time, besides the Connecticut location, there were 4 Florida locations.
Oh, I know who that was.
Tell us.
John Callahan. But let's back up a little to the same year that Callahan took over World Hyalai. The Daytona Beach Fronton's license to operate was officially revoked on March 5th of 1974. The following month, it was conveniently destroyed by a fire. Mafia boss from Springfield, Massachusetts, named Salvatore Big Nose Cufari, was later implicated in the crime. It was the first of 2 Fronton fires in Florida. The second would take place in 1978. The Daytona Beach Fronton was owned by Emprise Corporation, which we briefly mentioned in episode 32, A Day at the Races. Emprise was founded by Louis M. Jacobs and later run by his sons, Jeremy and Max. The corporation was involved in the sports industry, including food and concessions at racetracks and sports stadiums across the U.S. Emprise supposedly loaned large sums of money to Berkshire Downs, which Raymond Patriarca allegedly had a large stake in before it went bankrupt. and Emprise received a $4 million insurance payout for the fire.
In June of 1974, Emprise sought a permit for a new Fronton in Polk County, Florida, at the same time that World High Light also applied for their operating license.
Okay, so let's tell our listeners about World High Light, also known as WJA.
Do it.
So High Light was brought to the U.S. when the first Fronton opened in May 15th, 1904 at the World's Fair in St. Louis, Missouri.
You always get to do the fun fact stuff, but I found one this time. When Christopher Columbus returned to Spain after his second voyage to the Americas, he returned with a rubber ball, which was used by the Aztecs and Mayans in Mexico, which he gifted to the Spanish royal court. The Basques were intrigued by the bounce it had, and it probably inspired the future balls used in High Life.
Hey, you know our cousin Henry VII was said to have been an excellent player?
Can we fast forward 500 years?
Hey, you're the one that took us back to Christopher Columbus.
I was intending to move on, not drag our cousin out of the mothballs.
Okay. As we mentioned earlier, the first permanent Fronton opened in the U.S. in 1924 when construction of the Miami Fronton was completed at... Wait, you had to say it for me.
Hialeah.
Hialeah. The owner was Richard Berenson. When he passed away in 1967, his son Buddy took over. The company was doing well and looking to expand. So in 1973, the company chairman, Benjamin Trustman, started looking for a bank to loan them money. His own bank, National Shawmut, did not have the kind of money that World High Light needed, so he reached out to another local Boston bank, the First National Bank of Boston. The bank agreed to help finance the build out, but it turned out that they had some terms, which just goes to show, once again, that there's no such thing as a free lunch.
Amen to that. In December of 1974, good old John Callahan was elected president of World High Light after some wrangling amongst the board members. Berenson was sidelined, and his role as GM of Miami High Light was given to the GM of Tampa High Light, Ernie Larson Jr. Callahan was brought in by the Boston bankers to oversee the expansion of High Light. Two more Florida Frontons were already stated to open in Ocala and Fort Pierce. Now, under Callahan's new leadership, things started changing fast. In addition to Ernie Larson replacing Berenson at Miami, Callahan brought in his own people from Boston.
First, he brought in Winter Hill hanger-on Brian McNeely to oversee the concessions, and McNeely had no experience in concessions, just to make that very clear there. Then, an unnamed computer consultant was hired for $50,000 a year.
Yeah, a consultant.
Hey, you don't know. It's possible. He was consulting on how to launder money, probably.
Yeah, probably.
Anyhow, as we mentioned in the previous episode, H. Paul Rico retired from the FBI on May 27, 1975. Just a little over a week later, on June 8th, the Miami Herald reported that Rico had been named VP and Director of Security for World High Light. One of Rico's first hires was Richard Garrity, another special agent who had also only recently retired after a 24-year career in Newark, New Jersey.
In October, John Callahan's business partner Richard Donovan was elected VP and Controller of World High Light. In February of 1976, Rico was named VP and GM of Miami High Light. Garrity was sent to Tampa High Light to replace Ernie Larson as general manager. Larson's exit came as a shock to everyone. The former Navy veteran had overseen a lot of changes at World High Light and was credited with increasing profits at Tampa by over five times.
The Hartford, Connecticut High Light opened its doors on May 20th, 1976, but not before the Connecticut Stateys investigated Callahan. He lied to the Stateys and they followed him to Boston, where they saw him with Johnny Modorano and Brian Halloran on multiple occasions. Rico and Donovan forced Callahan out to save the reputations and to ensure that the doors to Hartford High Light would open and remain that way. Donovan immediately hired former special agent Gerald Jerry Coakley as the assistant GM. Coakley had also just recently retired from a 25-year career at the FBI. Rico, Denny Condon, Coakley, and Garrity had all joined the FBI at the same time in 1951.
You know, I'm actually surprised that Condon didn't get involved in any of this.
I'm not. He liked to keep his employment above board and in the public sector. And remember, he never really sought, like, promotions. Remember that? He was offered promotions and he never...
Yeah, he always just laid low.
Yeah. Anyway, but he does have a bizarre tie back to this story, which is a little teaser to keep you guys listening. Okay, back to the timeline. The Bridgeport location opened on June 1st, followed by your favorite haunt, the Newport High Lie, on June 10th. The following year, in January of 77, Buddy Berenson sued World after Donovan forced him out. Even though Berenson still owned 14% of the company's stock through a voting trust.
Berenson's lucky he didn't get bumped off.
Hey, if I were him, I would have been fantasizing about bumping them off.
If only he knew the lives that would be lost and not on the court.
Hey, do you want to list the names of the victims now?
Sure. They were Peggy Westcoat and Jerry Subby on December 5th, 1980 in Dade, Florida. Roger Wheeler on May 27th, 1981 in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Brian Halloran and Michael Donahue on May 11, 1982 in Boston, and John B. Callahan on August 2, 1982 in Miami. To be clear, Mikey Donahue was not a target of Whitey Bulger and Company, but lost his life because he gave Halloran a ride.
And Jerry Subby was also in the wrong place at the wrong time, the boyfriend of Peggy Westcoat. Do you want to go into full detail about their murders and Callahan in this episode, or are we going to looking at breaking this into two?
That's a good question. Let's see how much of the highlight story we can get through if we are creeping past the previously promised 30 to 40 minute max mark, then maybe we'll do it in two.
Okay, well, if it's two, let's keep them back to back.
Deal. In March of 1977, the High Lie investigation and Berenson's lawsuit were national news.
Yeah, it read more like a tabloid piece, though. They told the story of how Berenson had been fired after going to the FBI and other unnamed law enforcement agencies to report that organized crime figures had their hooks into World High Lie. He was seeking to have his employment restored and to block the board of directors from declaring him an unqualified stockholder, which would force him to sell his 14% stake in the company that his father had founded. Jack Cooper placed the blame on Berenson for his own plight, stating that Berenson shouldn't have raised such allegations.
Bailiffs announced the month before that they intended to acquire WJA for some $66 million. Now, in case you were wondering how Cooper found himself at WGA, J-A.
Hey, I'm not wondering. Retired FBI agent H. Paul Rico claimed that he introduced Cooper to the director of WJA, Alan Trustman, the son of Benjamin Trustman. Another Massachusetts native, Trustman, who is still kicking at the age of 94, is best known for writing the screenplay for the Thomas Crown Affair. Rico testified that it was Cooper, whom he met at the dog track, who asked him to make the introduction. He also testified that he recommended to WJA that they drop Cooper because of the adverse publicity he would bring, because Rico remembered reading Cooper's FBI file, which said that he was an associate of Meyer Lansky and Eddie Levinson. And, you know, I actually found a file in the JFK docs that says that Cooper was interested in High Lie as far back as 62.
That's very interesting. But why did Rico even bother to make the intro then, or at least let Trustman know ahead of time that he was connected, that Cooper was connected?
Do you actually believe that story, though?
No, but I kind of had to ask anyhow.
Well, to be fair, Rico was questioned whether he found it interesting that Cooper was linked to Lansky and whether or not he told Berenson. Rico claimed he was interested and he believed he told Berenson of the relationship.
A relationship that he claimed was a casual one going back to the 1940s when Lansky had casinos in Florida to when Lansky was deported from Israel in 72. But there was footage of Berenson and Lansky together as recently as 1974.
Well, the Florida case dragged on and the Connecticut investigation continued, but that didn't stop another Fronton from opening its doors. On May 5th, 1977, Milford High Lie was drawing crowds of spectators and gamblers. By then, there were 15 Frontons operating around the country. World was the largest single owner with four Frontons in Florida, Tampa, Miami, Ocala, Fort Pierce, and one in Hartford, Connecticut.
And Hartford was raking in the cash. Quote, the purse at Hartford averages more than $400,000 for 12 games, multiplied by 6 nights a week, and the Saturday matinee, that's $2.8 million weekly, end quote.
Well, you can see why it was so attractive to the mafia in Winter Hill.
And Rico, who by November of that year was promoted again, this time as a board member of World High Life.
And now we need to introduce Roger Wheeler.
For sure. A month after Rico joined the board, Tulsa-based Phoenix Resources, Inc. proposed a merger with WJA. The owner of Phoenix and the chairman of Telex, Roger Wheeler, was offering $15 a share for his 3,565,000 shares.
Wheeler had his fingers in many different interests, including oil, gas, and mining, but he had recently been burned when some of his mining investments didn't pan out, so he started looking at legalized gambling, including racetracks. Racetracks, Bally's slot machine parlors, and even a casino in Vegas. When all of those deals fell through, David McCown, a loan officer at the First National Bank of Boston, suggested World High Life.
How convenient that it was the First National Bank of Boston to come up with that brainstorm.
Convenient? You mean suspicious?
Well, that too.
Well, not to Wheeler. After 10 days of meetings at his vacation home in Nantucket, McCown had convinced Wheeler that the opportunity was a no-brainer. Wheeler was all in, and over the next 6 months, the bank and he worked out a deal. Everett H. Parker was the attorney who formed the limited partnership specifically for the purchase of WJA, named WJA Realty, for Wheeler's purchase of World High Life. Wheeler and his wife held 50% of the shares. The other shareholder was a Delaware entity named Phoenix Resources, Inc., which, as Laura mentioned a couple of minutes ago, was owned by Wheeler and whose president was James L. Mandel. Wheeler's children were named general partners in the limited partnership for asset protection purposes.
But that wasn't enough to protect Wheeler.
Yeah, I don't think protecting his life was what he had in mind.
Yes, I get that he was only trying to protect his finances. And speaking of finances, the First National Bank received $550,000 for brokering the deal, and Continental Illinois received $450,000 for their participation, a nice clean 55-45 split. In addition, First National financed the majority of the $50 million.
How is that any different than what the government accused Provenzano and the Romanos of doing in our previous episode?
It's really no different, but it wasn't a deal between mobsters and unions.
Hey, the only element that was different was the lack of union involvement.
Well, this is true, and half of the players in the story, I assume, were blind to the fact that their partners, seen or silent, were mobsters.
The suspicions and allegations were in the papers. You could have just opened the Boston Herald or the Globe or whatever.
Well, then greed or whatever made them turn a blind eye.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. Back to the deal. So the contract explicitly stated that Richard Donovan would stay on as CEO and that if Wheeler wanted...
This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell. Fast. To our 38 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 site credit when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
A new CEO, the bank would get to choose his replacement.
$50 million comes with a price.
And so did the gambling business. The state of Florida conducted an investigation into Wheeler's moral character, quote unquote. Financier McCown was transparent with state investigators about the deal, but it was clear that Wheeler was essentially just a frontman for the tarnished WJA, and Donovan and Rico would remain in control of daily operations. Despite the sullied situation, the Florida Commission approved the merger on First National Bank's assurance that Callahan was absolutely no longer involved in World High Life.
The following year, in February of 78, Rico threatened to sue Harvey Ziskus for defamation of character over allegations that Ziskus had made about cheating going on at High Life. Rico countered that Ziskus had an axe to grind because he tossed out Rico countered that Ziskus had an axe to grind because he was tossed out of the Hartford High Lie after he retained a betting slip that he had already collected his winnings on. The Florida Commission, where Ziskus' case was filed, found that there were grounds to investigate his claims.
For the sake of our timeline, I just want to mention here that 4 months later in June, the Blackfriars Massacre took place in Boston. We covered that in a previous episode, so if you haven't listened to that one yet, check it out.
Never miss an opportunity to plug an episode.
Hey, someone has to because you don't.
Ouch. Okay, back to High Lie. In July, WJA voted unanimously to merge with WJA Realty, and with that, the deal was official.
But it wasn't a shoe-in. X-Core International had tried to outbid Wheeler, offering an additional $33 million to the offer. But as X-Core's chairman, Louis Nicastro, pointed out, quote, "If it's so damn good and everybody thinks it's good, why are they selling it so damn cheaply? Why are they so eager to sell?" Unquote.
The $50 million question.
Hey, that was supposed to be my one-liner.
You snooze, you lose.
Mm-hmm. Then, the following month, Hartford High Lie was found guilty by the Connecticut Gaming Commission for failing to report a player-fixing scheme and fined $70,000. But the fine was reduced in December by an appeals judge. Donovan and Rico were each told to pay $5,000, and the judge said it was, quote, "an honest misunderstanding," unquote.
In their defense, it seemed to be a squabble over high rollers getting comped meals and drinks, which is normal in casinos, at least.
You are being far too kind to these people. I'm sorry. Anyhow, on December 26th, the West Palm Beach Fronton was destroyed by a suspicious fire. Officials stated that it was arson. The West Palm Beach Fronton was owned by Arthur Sylvester, formerly Silvestri. He would go on to sue Geraldo Rivera after Geraldo said that Sylvester had burnt down the Fronton for the insurance money. To add to the suspicion, Sylvester had increased his insurance coverage from $4 to $8 million just a couple of months before the fire. And magically, the actual damages came out to $8 million. Sylvester lost his lawsuit against Geraldo even though the fire was ruled arson and no charges were ever brought against Sylvester.
I can't think of Geraldo and not think of Al Capone's vault. Anyhow, in February of 1979, Wheeler gave his first interview in nearly a decade. He pointed out that he felt sufficiently well protected because he was surrounded by FBI types, specifically six former agents, if he only knew what was to come.
And that was the same month that Johnny Modorano took it on the lam after Whitey and Stevie told him about the coming indictments in the race-fixing scheme with Howie Winter.
The following year, on November 21st, the MGM Grand Hotel had a devastating fire that claimed the lives of 85 people. The Fronton was shuttered until 81, but did it actually ever reopen?
I have no idea about that. World didn't own that one, just to be clear, you
guys. No, I know. No, but earlier we talked about the Kirk Kerkorian situation. Yeah. And I thought when it closed after the fire that it did not reopen. But
yeah, I don't know.
Okay, we're going to have to double check that.
Okay. In December of 1980, Miami High Lie cashier Peggy Westcoat and her boyfriend Jerry Subby were found murdered in her home. She had been hung by a rope which had been fed into the kitchen garbage disposal, and Jerry was hung just inside the front door. The police initially believed it was drugs, but Roger Wheeler wasn't so sure. He sent his son to do his own investigation. In 2007, authorities were trying to link DNA evidence from the murder scene to Whitey Bulger, but the murders still remain technically unsolved.
Just awful. The whole, didn't her brother and her father get killed also?
Yes, her father got killed a couple of years before she did, and then the brother died a couple of years after her, I think. But I don't know, maybe it really was drugs.
I don't know. In March of 1981, Wheeler sold the Hartford Fronton to Berenson. The scandals were piling up, and he was desperate to get rid of it, and Berenson wanted back in. quote, "I even remember him, Wheeler, telling me somewhat in jest, I take it, that he would have given away the Hartford Fronton to a Catholic charity just to wash his hands of it," end quote. Gary Rutledge recalled this story shortly after Wheeler was killed, less than 2 months later.
Yeah, I don't think Wheeler was joking, though.
Me either.
In April, Wheeler sent his son, Larry, back to Miami to check out the situation. Larry reported that Rico acted like he owned the place. As Larry sat in anonymity in the cafe, eating an overdone steak and a wilted salad, he watched as Rico was served a sirloin. I wonder if Wheeler was still feeling as safe as he was when he first purchased WJA.
At least pissed off. And from his actions up to that point, he was at least growing more and more uncomfortable with his current business venture, but not early enough to run for his life.
Well, at the beginning of May, a World Highlight expense report showed that Rico, in his capacity as World Highlight director, entertained FBI special agents Tom Dowd and Jerry Forrester in the Bahamas. If you listen to our previous episode, we discussed Rico's involvement as an undercover operative in the Elsie Hastings sting operation. During Hastings' impeachment trial in the U.S. Senate, Rico testified that Tom Dowd's wife was an employee of Miami High Life. I want to note that in 1981, the sport of High Life took in some $625 million in bets.
625 million reasons to want to keep the money flowing and not allow anything to get in the way.
And that's when Wheeler finally decided to take control of WJA. He reportedly told his sons a week before he died that he planned to fire both Rico and Richard Donovan, but by then it was too late.
And that brings us to May 27th. Roger Wheeler was gunned down in front of 14 witnesses outside of his country club.
And one of the first cops on the scene was a former student of Denny Condon's from back in Boston.
And there was your little hook that you gave to all of us. Stevie Fleming almost immediately became a suspect, but the Boston FBI field office blocked other feds and local authorities from attempting to bring Fleming in for questioning. They had to protect their star informant.
In January of 82, Brian Halloran, who by now was facing murder charges for the slaying of Georgie Pappas, went to the FBI to make a deal for himself. He told them that he was offered the contract to kill Wheeler. But the Fed spent 6 weeks, quote-unquote, debriefing him before deciding he wasn't credible. But we all know that it had nothing to do with credibility and everything to do with protecting their golden boys, Stevie Fleming and Whitey Bulger. But they continued to string Halloran along until May 11th when he and Mikey Donahue were ambushed thanks to Special Agent Zip Connolly telling Whitey that Halloran was informing on them.
Okay, Mikey was my favorite knock-knock joke victim.
Well, you're going to have to explain that one.
When I was little, we had Dixie cups that were basically paper with wax coating in the late 70s, and they had knock-knock jokes on them. You know, knock-knock, who's there? Orange. Orange who? Aren't you glad you met me?
Well, before my time, but I do get it.
Mikey was a good sport and a really kind person, so he'd humor me and let me try out my knock-knock jokes on him. And once in a while, he'd give me a little scratch in my dollhouse, and he had that big macaw that used to need to give him time out in the bathroom because he was always cussing. I think the bird's name was Joey.
There are way too many birds in these stories, and that just reminds me of the Mina bird from the Bonded Vault episode.
And for the most, Dad really hated birds and was beyond superstitious about them. I blame that on Jack for forcing him to cover the bird poop on the car with newspaper when they were planning a score. No beloved car wash until after the heist was complete. But all those guys had birds. And then when he came to live with me, I had birds. At first, he was out of his mind, but then he was the biggest fan of the birds.
Well, see, people do change.
Well, that's pushing a little bit.
Well, speaking of pushing things or stretching the truth, Jeremiah O'Sullivan was fully aware that Stevie Fleming was an informant and had to have some inkling, and I am being very generous here, that the murders that Stevie and company were being looked at for were more than likely committed by Stevie and Winter Hill.
But he and the feds had such an obsession with taking down Angiulo and his crew that Whitey and Stevie could have killed the Pope and they would have run cover for them. And that goes back to when Buddy McLean ran Winter Hill.
And there was Rico right in the middle of it all, just like in the 60s. In July, detectives from Tulsa went to Boston to pursue a lead in the Wheeler murder. Like you said, O'Sullivan was using Bulger and Flemmy to build the case against Angiulo. And I want to remind you that O'Sullivan had known for 3.5 years at that point that they were FBI informants, but he never told the Massachusetts State Police or the detectives from Oklahoma about them. Instead, he obfuscated and told them that Halloran had tried to join the witness protection program and someone must have gotten wind of it.
Yeah, more magic. And it's not like he was going to tell them that Zip got him killed, but I'm sorry, he had to have known.
Well, you're not going to get an argument from me. It was the old Irish Boys Club. And another fun fact for all of you, O'Sullivan and Zip Connolly both graduated from BC the same year, and neither of them served in the military, although at least Jeremiah O'Sullivan had something of an excuse. Anyway, O'Sullivan would testify 2 decades later at the government reform hearings that he did not recall telling Sergeant Huff from Tulsa during the Wheeler murder investigation that Rico socialized with Winter Hill gang members.
Socialized isn't what I'd call it.
Hey, no sane person would. Huff also said that O'Sullivan told him that Zip Connolly had business dealings with Winter Hill members, but again, O'Sullivan denied that the conversation went that way, and we mentioned that in a previous episode too, so I don't remember which one though.
Okay.
Sorry, guys.
We will dedicate many episodes in season 4 to the hearings and Rico's demise.
Okay, for sure. But back to 82. In July, Continental Illinois went under. Later that month, good old Jimmy Sims was pinched in Key West after 6 years on the lam, but his fellow lamster, Joe Mack, was still in the wind.
Then on August 3rd, a parking lot attendant at the Miami-Dade International Airport came upon a Cadillac Fleetwood Brougham that was emitting a foul odor. As he got closer, he saw something dripping from the trunk, and he immediately called the police.
Oh, it was August in Miami. It must have smelled awful.
The body was badly decomposed and stripped of any identification. The police traced the vehicle to a leasing company in Woburn, Mass., and were pretty certain that the dead man was Callahan, which they confirmed by his fingerprints the following day. The man who bragged that he had known Johnny Mutterano since they were little kids met his end at Johnny's hands, although that wouldn't be revealed until Johnny made his own deal with the government in 1999. More about that at the end of season 3, and since we've gotten this far, I think we're going to keep this in one episode.
Okay, let's do it, but we'll wrap it up today in 1985, since that will tie into our first episode of season 3.
Okay, so back to 1982. In August, the FBI said they knew the identity of Wheeler's killer and that the Boston field office told them about Halloran and how he turned down the contract. But they never named names. The following month, the Connecticut Stateies told their Florida counterparts that they believed Wheeler was killed because of the embezzlement at World Highline. One of Wheeler's sons confirmed his suspicions. Meanwhile, Tulsa asked for a grand jury investigation and requested that Rico be subpoenaed as a witness, but their requests were denied.
The following month, Somerville legend Joe Mack was arrested in New York City. And like Jimmy Sims, Mack had been on the lam for 6 years. You can hear more about why they were on the run and some of what they were up to in the Hit Parade of 76. In October, World Highline was raided and their books were seized, but the government was unable to make a case. At the end of the month, the federal grand jury was convened, minus Rico and his testimony.
That didn't stop the DOJ from investigating, and they created a task force for the purpose including gathering information on Rico and sought information about Rico specifically, but the Connecticut delegates refused to cooperate and walked out. Meanwhile, WJA sued to get their seized files back, and they were partially victorious. The DOJ returned the financial records, except those from 76 to 81, and oh gee, I wonder why.
No, you don't. You know exactly why. The skimming allegations at two of the Connecticut frontons, Dahlia and Hartford, continued. One glaring discrepancy was that more tickets were cashed in as winners than were sold, followed by winning tickets being cashed in twice. The Revenue Service claimed that millions of dollars had been siphoned off going back to at least to 77, and the investigations continued without any impact.
Now let's wrap up with the First National Bank of Boston being fined $500,000 after pleading guilty in the U.S. District Court for unreported transactions totaling over $1.2 billion between First National and Swiss banks, including Nina's favorite, Credit Suisse. The scheme was exposed after money laundering charges were brought against Jerry Angiulo, who will be opening season 3 with Jerry's downfall, and will go into detail about the money laundering charges along with all of the other charges.
I stand by my theory that some of the $50 million that First National provided for Wheeler's purchase of World was part of what they were washing for Jerry. Callahan had a plush office in their main branch back in those days. It all had to be connected.
I agree, and although it probably burnt Rico and the Fed's asses that they were putting money in Jerry's pockets in the short term, they knew in the long term it would help put him away.
Well, for sure. And as we said earlier, it wouldn't be until 1999 when Johnny Modirano cooperated with the Feds that there was an answer to who killed Wheeler and Callahan. Kevin Weeks would make his own deal with the Feds that included revealing who killed Halloran and Mikey Donahue. Mikey offered his neighbor Halloran a ride home. Weeks and Whitey were communicating via walkie-talkie. Weeks told him that Halloran was in range. Whitey called out to Halloran and began firing. Mikey was killed instantly, but Halloran stumbled out of the car and Whitey kept shooting. He wouldn't face justice for their murders until 2013, when he was convicted of their slaying along with 9 others.
Sadly, the body count was much higher and no one will ever serve a day for them. Okay, next episode, we are back with Jack Kelly's Justice the Redo. He surfaces to finish the job he started with H. Paul Rico and to right more than a handful of wrongs that weren't part of his original plan.
And that is all for now. Thanks, everyone. See you next time.
Thank you. Bye.
When your company earns unlimited 2% cash back on all purchases with Capital One, that's serious business. So, Steven at SandCloud got a serious business card, the Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One.
We used our 2% cash back to help build our retail presence.
Savvy, Steven.
And we get big purchasing power, so our business can spend more and earn more.
The Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One. What's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.